Welcome, everybody. Gabriella has a question, so we'll start with Gabriella, and I'm going to unmute you.
Okay.
Hello.
Nice to see familiar faces on tonight, Carrie and Sarah and Hannah.
Yes.
I've been spending this time now that I'm at home more intensely, reconnecting with the pleasure of cooking. So before this all came about, I had reached a stage in my life where cooking wasn't so much important. My kids were grown up, my husband was traveling, so I was kind of so happy to just do away with those duties of being a mom, a wife, and really found them at some point, many points during my time, quite almost depressive sometimes. I had this love-hate relationship with cooking, but now I've come back and just really experiencing it as a really, powerful feminine practice. And I don't know if I've ever heard you speak about it as a feminine practice, and so I just wanted to get your views about it. And what is your advice to women who are having to cook more and during this time, and for families, and what would you have to say with that stigma it sometimes has, right, of being of being oppressive, of being a role that women are sort of pigeonholed to. And then maybe I'm also noticing, because my husband and I do share the responsibilities of cooking, I'm not the only one, but now also interesting to see the way he approaches cooking versus the way I approach it. And so if there's, you know, with all these celebrity male chefs as coming out, and they seem to take center stage sometimes to women who've traditionally held this role. Just interesting in that dynamic of
yes,
how the role of cooking has evolved, and I'm curious about your views on it as a feminine practice, yeah, and maybe a spiritual practice. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Well, I would definitely say it's a spiritual practice. Steve, do you want to start or shall I start? Steve is a very good cook, by the way.
So, oh, really?
That's why,
oh,
I'm,
wow,
referring to him. And not only is he a very good cook, he's also unbelievably efficient in cleaning after he's cooked, which is
that's
virtue
a
all in itself. Yeah. So, I don't know. Shall I start or will you start?
Why don't you start? Yeah.
Okay, good. So there were several people in the chats, by the way, going, yeah, I have to cook all the time too. Good question. You know, all kinds of things. So I can proudly say that my sourdough starter is ready today to be used,
oh, nice,
for baking. So I think everybody is going for that. And for instance, you know, here you can't even get flour in the shops because everybody's baking and cooking. So I think there's a few things to be said about that. I don't think we want to pigeonhole cooking as a feminine practice necessarily, right?
Yeah, okay.
Because it kind of conflates things a bit. I think traditionally for many, 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 many years, cooking was the domain of women in the context of both society, right, and also from a gender role perspective, because of nourishment and the feeding of children, right, feeding of the tribe in general. So I think there is a aspect to that that is very gender role based, for right or wrong reasons we can discuss endlessly, right. It practically speaking, it makes total sense that she who feeds a baby from her breast then goes to feeding the baby in other ways, and so on and so on, right? And somebody's got to hunt and somebody's got to prepare the food. So I don't think there is necessarily something bad about that, because cooking in its essence has some of the really quintessential aspects of being a human being or and caring for human beings, right? It's nourishment. So it has a sustenance and survival aspect to it. And then with it, within the sustenance and survival aspect, there is kind of an art form or a devotional quality to it, right? And the devotional quality is the nourishing those you love, nourishing your tribe, providing something extra on top of the function of, yeah, well, here's a hunk of mammoth, eat it, right? But it's like, how can I make the hunk of mammoth visually appealing and also taste really good? That's the art form and also the devotional or spiritual aspect to cooking, right? So I think it can be kind of pulled apart a bit where you can go, well, we all have to eat and somebody has to make the food. So whoever is best at making the food should be making the food. Or previously it was like, well, you had a certain role to play. So that was your role. You had a job. The other person you were with or the other part people in the tribe had a job. Everybody did their job. Then comes the, can we make the job pleasing and artful? And is there added enjoyment in that, right? So when we then look, you were saying, well, why are there male chefs and they take front and center? I think because, well, there's a bunch of reasons for that. But I think one of the things that you could potentially feel is that often when male chefs go to work on food, they don't just bring the functional aspect into food, right? That, well, we're gonna eat, so let's make some food. But the people that are revered have an artistic aspect to them. Right? Mm-hmm. Not necessarily a nourishing aspect or a caring aspect. Yes, it should taste good, but it's not exactly like there's a lot of food or whatever, right? Like it becomes an art form. Food becomes elevated, and the preparation of food and the good chef takes food out of the realm of nourishment and into the realm of performance and art and kind of an opening of the body towards art. And if somebody cooks really good, certainly an opening of the body towards God, because good food is definitely a God realm, you know? Mm. So I think when we look at, you know, everybody having to make food now, we can look at it from the viewpoint of a chore. And there's lots of chores right now for everyone, right? Yeah. And most people have a lot more at-home things that they have to do, and they're not all pleasant. But we can also look at it as an act of supreme nourishment, as a way of caring for ourselves, you know, and others. And we can also look at it from a devotional or artistic viewpoint, right? And so, for instance, you know, you've heard me talk about this before. My teacher endlessly made me do chai.
Oh, the chai, yeah.
Make chai, right? And the making of the chai had all those components. It had the learning about the medicinal properties of the different ingredients and really feeling what they did in the body and what they did in my body and how my body reacted to it. For instance, I'm mildly allergic to black pepper, which is one of the ingredients that you can put in chai. And that became very apparent when I started working with larger doses of black pepper. So I got to learn about the ingredients in my own body. So there's that aspect. And then there's the aspect of devotional activity, which is that the making of the chai was an offering to something greater than myself, and was in the spirit of taking myself and my likes and dislikes out of the equation and performing the offering. And then there's, of course, a supremely nurturing quality to it, because it is good and it tastes good and people love it. And then there's an artistic quality to it, because you can perfect the chai making and do the thing in a way that has kind of a art/performance aspect to it that's also interesting, right? So those are a few thoughts on cooking. And I think that the thing that I'm finding right now with cooking is that I go back and forth between just function, right? Where I make food and I prep food up front so I can just eat when eating is required during all the other things I need to do. And then I have moments where it's really just about nurturing or nourishing or feeling good, where there's a certain amount of comfort. For instance, bread, I never eat bread. So making bread and eating bread is kind of like, it's totally in the comfort realm, essentially. But it's also in the artistic and adventure realm because I've never made a sourdough loaf. And so it's kind of like, can I learn something new? Can I engage in something that stimulates me and that makes me feel like I'm doing something with my time and my attention that then stimulates other parts of my brain or makes me try other things? And so there's an aspect of adventure you can, engage in with every activity that you're doing right now, and certainly with food, because you have to make food anyway. So might as well, right? Might as well do something with that and try something out,
Yeah, I think it's that latter one that I'm having. I want to bring more of.
Yes.
The adventure creative part. I mean, I know that, it's natural for me to nourish, and the devotional aspect, I do see some of that, the abundance, the gratitude for what I have before me. But it's the performative and adventurous and creative aspect. I'm outdone by that, by my husband, actually. He's really, really good at that. And I just didn't know if, would like to sort of bring that more of that in. Not really quite sure.
Well, there's a million websites with a million how-tos, and I just found one that's called Kitchen, but with a kitchen without the E in the end. So it's KITCHN.com. And they have like a million like really specific baking and cooking and this and that. So you can definitely find stuff where you can, explore and, do things. Or maybe you'll find some recipe from your grandmother that you haven't made ever and connect with your ancestry while you're nourishing and while you're being adventurous. I mean, there's endless ways that you can use the ordinary to create adventure and also sacredness, right? Which is, as you well know, one of my favorite things to explore is how can you make the ordinary sacred and the sacred ordinary?
I think for me, I was just trying to tune into, because we were, I'm doing the pleasure course with you, just attuning to the pleasure aspect from a multi-sensory aspect.
Yes.
And that's what I would like to connect with more.
Yes, 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 absolutely. Right. So coming back to my famed sourdough starter.
Yeah.
That I'm so proud of. It's sitting on top of my fridge because it's warm and whatever, right? And so when I walk through the house and when I walk through the kitchen, at certain times I catch a whiff of that sourdough starter and my entire body goes, because it has a smell that you know as something, baked bread. I mean, it's like, not much that's more pleasurable than baked bread. And so it's really interesting to feel that, as I traverse the house, and yesterday I was cleaning and stuff, I get a whiff and then my entire body reacts to that. And when you have one of those moments, it's good to kind of stop and go, and let that be had as a means of enlivening. Right. And awakening, because, in the pleasure course, that's all we're talking about, the awakening of the pleasure body. But I think it's nice to play around with that.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Okay, Brianna, I'm gonna unmute you.
Hi, Michaela.
Hi.
So I have a question that I think that there's a general theme here, and then like I can bring it to a specific, and it's how to navigate when a couple has competing or conflicting needs, particularly in a time of crisis like now. And the specific example is, so the man that I've been in a serious relationship now, his ex-wife is very controlling and manipulative and pits the kids against him by telling them lies and stuff. So it's not infrequent that he has to rush to put out a fire. And, you know, we're all going through different challenges at this point in time, but right before we came into this health crisis, our relationship was coming to a point where I was like, okay, there needs to be more give and take here because I am a person too. Children come first, but I am also a person with needs and can't just be shoved to the side every time the ex-wife creates drama. And he needs like, and he allows it to happen. He doesn't stand up. He doesn't set the record straight. They did just start counseling together as a family, because I was like, you guys need to please get counseling. And but so I'm dealing with a situation now where I've learned that my grandmother's in a facility where they have coronavirus now on her wing, and some other challenges, and I'm really particularly in need of some support. And the ex-wife told him last night he had to go to Santa Barbara with them. And she drove by and picked him up. And she basically, again, used the kids. And so he's like, I can't talk to you this week. And I'm saying, wow, you can't leave the house to go for a walk to talk to me while I'm concerned about my grandmother. I'm concerned about my business failing. You're a finance person. You've been helping me navigate some of this. So how do you, when there are two competing needs, like I understand there has to be some compromise, but how do you find where, sorry, that's my loud cat. How do you find the place where, do you know what I'm saying? Where you're not a doormat and yet you are conscientious of the other person's very real needs also.
Yeah, that's a tough one. There's a few emails here that people sent with similar things, right? Where people are with ex-partners or partners and the values just don't line up. And that's at the best of times not easy, right? And at the best of times, the lack of common values or the lack of common thread is kind of what they call an irreconcilable difference. But of course, in a crisis, the thin veneer of social behavior and pretend kind of wears off really quickly, and we see that everywhere with people where they've been kind of keeping it somewhat together under normal circumstances, and now that the circumstances are very pressured, they're just not capable of doing all the things that they need to be doing or behaving the way that they need to behave. So there's a bigger picture, and then there's the immediate thing, right? So the bigger picture, of course, is that if you're with somebody who prioritizes away or outside of your needs consistently, the first step, of course, is to make your needs very clear in the most comfortable way possible, right? And polite way possible. So that's the first step, of course. Then the second step is if your needs are consistently not met, or if there's a consistent complaint that doesn't shift, then that's, of course, an actual situation and a potential grounds for, figuring other things out.
Right.
So that's that. But within that, of course, there's always the, are you actually asserting your needs, appropriately and properly? Appropriately is more your tone and the way you go at it. Properly is, are you actually capable of asking for what you need in a way that it is understood by the other person? Right. So there's that. I'm just going to put that there. Right. And you understand that, you know. Mm-hmm. Now, in a crisis situation, well, now let me say one other thing about this, because that's the thing that goes into the crisis situation. So when you're with someone who has a history of, let's call it bad relationship, because that's a bad relationship, right? There's a certain special place in hell for mothers who turn their children against their fathers, right? I mean,
I think so. Yeah,
there is, and that hell is, you know, it comes to fruition when the kids are a little bit older, usually. But that's a different story, right? But that says something about him as well, right? Now, not in a way that he's a bad human being, and clearly he didn't tolerate it forever and ever because they are divorced. So he was clearly capable of identifying that this wasn't a good situation and got out of that situation, but he's acclimated, right? And so his normal is not your normal. And his perception is not your perception because he's acclimated. It's like the, you know, that proverbial frog in the hot water or in the water that starts boiling, right? It's definitely such that he doesn't have the same baseline you have. Mm-hmm. And he probably also has a fair share of guilt because of the kids and because of the way it went, and probably a fair share of guilt that he got in there in the first, you know, place and so on. So he isn't coming from the place that you can see from the outside. Mm-hmm. And he's probably also somewhat, you know, head shy, meaning, you know, he's been hit one too many times. Yeah. So when there is even a threat of being hit, he'll already flinch and do what needs to be done, maybe even preemptively.
Totally.
So that there isn't massive drama. And of course, if it was just him and her, well, he could probably just cut her off. But with children in the mix, you have to somewhat sacrifice your own preferences for the good of the children, and she probably plays that well, right? Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I'm saying all of this to say, to bring it into the crisis situation, he probably has less resourced now than he's ever been, and she's probably a little bit more exaggerated in her behavior than she's ever been, and that's a pretty brutal recipe, mm-hmm. right? And then that's where you have he's trying to behave like a normal human being around you and take care of himself and not do certain things so he has some resources, and then he gets yanked out of that into, you know, into that kind of thing. So here's how you fix that, right? Because it's a worst case scenario. You have to just essentially look at, do you need to be the person who is louder than the other complaint so you get your needs met, right? Which is one option, right? People like that usually react to whoever screams the loudest. But if you don't want to do that, then you're probably going to have to state your needs very clearly and then move on to fulfilling them other places. You know, have somebody else talk with you about the business, have somebody else give you some comfort around that, which is not what you want, but you have to essentially assume that he's not capable of supplying the comfort that you need. And then that, of course, in the long run has to be looked at. Was this just an extreme situation? And when things even out, he gets back to being, you know, available and kind and there. Or is this chronic? No.
Right. Yeah, as we were coming into this whole health crisis, he was just starting to address. We were just starting to talk about these things. Right. So that I'm like, and then now not really able to address them.
Yes.
But I appreciate your answer.
Yeah. And that sucks, mm-hmm. right? And unfortunately, there's no real way out of that because it's in a certain way, a kind of a double bind that makes it so any which way you move, it's not good. And so the best thing in a situation like that is you have to step out all the way.
What I'm worrying with a little bit right now is like, I don't feel like now is a good time to make big decisions.
No, you know, it's definitely not.
Right?
When I say step out, I'm not saying leave him. Step out as in take yourself out of that particular drama, right?
Like find other support.
Yes, find other support. Don't expect it from him. Don't be mad at him. Don't assume that he is capable of giving you the things you want. Get them wherever you need to. Take care of yourself. Engage with him in the ways that are mutually pleasant and step away from the rest till it can actually be addressed. No, not a good time to make any rash decisions. Not any good time to make good decisions. Also, not really a good time to have like heavy duty talks unless it's necessary for maintaining sanity.
Right. Thank you.
Yeah.
Hi, Michaela.
Hi.
Thank you. And Steve, I've never met you before, so thank you both.
You guys only know each other virtually. And so, yes.
Yeah, exactly. My question, Michaela, has to do with daily practices and daily practices since COVID. And so in context, and Michaela knows this really well, my husband, who is like the best partner I could ever dreamed of, died 15 months ago. And so after his death, I took Michaela's course and I really have focused since COVID really just on daily feminine practices. And so I do nonlinear dance and I'm just very, very aware from a feminine standpoint, was really, really feeling great in my body, had everything going just right. And then COVID hit and this is my 25th day. I'm isolating alone. And what I started doing for my practices, not only do I do most of my feminine practices, but I've started to meditate twice in the morning and once at night. And both of them, they're two different people and they're just very delightful and they're like bookends to my day. And so I'm very aware, Michaela, you know, we've talked about this before about how, you know, meditating can really be much more masculine. What I've noticed in my body is I was feeling such exuberance in my body when I was only doing my feminine practices. Now I feel, I just don't feel as happy in my body, but psychically, I like the meditation that I'm doing. So my question after all that long-winded talk is like, am I canceling myself out by doing the meditations?
Good question. Well, so here are a few things to consider, right? So practice in general falls into, well, I should say this. Here's how I look at practice. One of the ways I look at practice, right? So there is practice that builds and that deepens skills and that expands your capacity, where you learn something new, you go deeper into your stuff, something happens, right? So let's call that the kind of skill building or expanding practice. And then there's remedial practice. And so remedial practice is the kind of practice you do in order to remedy something that's happening, right? So if I do, 8 hours of emails and then I do nonlinear, in that particular moment, that's a remedial practice. I'm just digging myself out of the hole. You know, I've dug myself into a hole as far as I'm disembodied and now I'm doing enough so that I'm out of the hole, but I haven't actually done anything beyond leveling out.
Yeah.
Right. But then for instance, if I notice that and I go, well, I don't want to just be leveled out. let me do another half hour of going out in the garden and cutting some flowers and putting some music on and cooking something. And now suddenly I can feel that there is an expansion in my system that's beyond zero, you know, beyond just feeling okay. Then I'm kind of in the expansive aspect of the practice and in the capacity building of the practice. So that's one aspect. Then the other thing is that, of course, some practices accomplish certain things while other practices accomplish other things, right? So for me, movement, embodiment, pleasure, enlivening, beauty, you know, all of that are practices that, as you say, bring out the more feeling sensitive, kind of non-linear, let's call it feminine, you know. Feminine is no longer really a good word, but everybody uses it. So that's that part. But sometimes I also need to meditate because, for instance, when I wrote the book, I had to at times meditate because I couldn't sleep anymore. Like my mind was going so crazy in the creative domain, and it got so much that I had to sit down and focus really, really, really strongly. And then I could put my creative swirl back on a piece of paper. So I would do remedial meditation practice and remedial movement practice as I needed it throughout the writing. And then from there, you can look at, well, you want to learn something new, right? So you use meditation as an expansive practice, meaning you're learning and you grow your capacity for focus or for concentration or for compassion or whatever it is that you're doing. So you're in a growth phase and you're using it not just to remedy, but to actually learn something, which of course allows you to use it remedially a lot better because you have practice under your belt. Right? So that's how you can look at it. So you have to decide then in the context of your isolation, what's more important, learning something and building a skill, or feeling really good and exuberant in your body.
Wow. Thank you. It's really helpful. I mean, I'm even noticing just on a Zoom, like the people who are sitting outside, I'm like, I want to be with them. I want to be outside. I want to be. So it is maybe I'm really leaning toward the exuberance, even though the purpose of the what I'm getting from the meditations really is community, because it's a community like this. The other thing, Michaela, that was so helpful, and I really get it. I have one little thing around that, and that is I'm also wondering if the grief has resettled inside of me, because we're all experiencing grief from this. And I was feeling like I was just kind of bursting through it physically, and then maybe the whole COVID thing, being isolated. Maybe that's what that heavier feeling is in me as well.
I was going to say that as well, right? So to finish kind of off the remedial versus, you know, skill learning, it's not that you shouldn't do those meditations, but maybe that means you have to do a little bit more on the exuberance aspect to counteract the kind of squashing in a bit down. But the other thing that you said so rightly is that this is a time of kind of a collective grief. And this is a time where certainly some of your loss and some of the engagement with the loss and sickness and, you know, the predictability of something happening that results in loss is front and center. Mm. You know, thankfully, you engaged so fully with your grief for so long, right? And so courageously, I might add. You know, I admire you tremendously in that way, and everything I see. You faced that thing with everything you had. So I think it's good to consider that maybe you are a little bit pulled back into that. And it's maybe submerged. mm-hmm. right? So it hasn't kind of popped up all the way, but it's making you a little bit more sluggish, a little bit more tired, a little bit more heavy, you know, not enough to pop up as the actual gloss, you know, where the bubble comes up from below and then pops and you go, oh, there it is. But just so that it makes you a bit heavier. Yeah. And then you have to see, then once again, we go with remedial practices, right? Then you have to see that, how do you wash out that submerged grief, right? You know, and why is it that the sitting feels good or not so good? So, you know, you kind of play with it, as in you know what you're dealing with and you attend to it so that you are in the best possible position. Because right now, the best you can do for yourself is to have the most exuberance and the most openness and the most surrender to the situation, while also attending to your grieving and loss and all of those things.
Michaela, thank you. That totally helps. I know what to do. It's really bumping up that the part where, yeah, I got it. It's bumping up the exuberant part, and you know, I have time to do that. So
yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. And thank you for the beautiful things you said. I really
appreciate that. Lovely seeing you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Bye. I'm going to mute you. Julia is next. Hello.
Hello, Michaela. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes. A very simple question. It refers perhaps a bit to Debbie's one. Some things I heard out of that. How do you prioritize in general for work, but also for during creative processes? And how do you use embodiment practice or meditation practice for that?
Okay, good. Yes, I think that's an excellent one. I'm going to give this to Steve first, because he definitely has been like crazy creative in the last couple of weeks. So I'm going to let him go first.
Okay, I didn't quite hear the first part.
How do you prioritize? How do you prioritize? What kind of practices do you use, and how do you prioritize? So, in the creative and work aspect, now that everybody's home, and you know, you do that. How do you get yourself to a productive space?
If you have too many ideas, or a lot of ideas, or a lot of projects, and you don't know where do I go first, like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and how would you use meditation or practicing to help you choose and prioritize? That's the question.
Something yeah. Like.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, when it comes to creativity, especially when we're in the early stages of being in lockdown or isolated or somewhat distanced from other people, is that creativity and productivity don't necessarily have to come together at the beginning. There's something about creativity that is general to all tasks that are creative, to all creative activity. So I think just doing something. If you're too concerned about prioritizing your creative tasks, then you may well choke the expression. So I would say to lower your standard of prioritization, assuming you have time and many ideas, which is what you're saying. Mm-hmm. If you wanted to be a creative and you didn't have any ideas, it would be different, of course. But seeing as you've got an overwhelming amount of ideas, just mm-hmm. do something, start something, and get the ball rolling. Get yourself into that get up and go state where you're up and you're doing things and you're exercising that creativity. And then what tends to happen is from that milieu of creative activity, something forms, some tone comes, the structure re-enters the picture. That tends to happen organically, and you get clear about this, or you start to really finish that, or you get tired of not quite getting around to doing the step two of this. And then some strange combination of inspiration and exasperation puts you into the valley of productivity. That's why in writing, we have the drafting or editing process. If you try to edit as you write, you choke the flow. You're trying to do two jobs at once, and they're not really the same job at all. And you don't do either one very well, and you tend to just choke the entire thing. You put an awful lot of demand on your creativity. You're asking the fetus of your creativity to be able to help out around the house. It's too early in the developmental stage. You've got to let the thing grow up a bit.
Yeah. And then I want to add one thing that I like that a lot. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I want to add another thing to that is when prioritizing within the busyness of a day is a different story, right?
Yeah.
So that's prioritizing mm-hmm. as to what to use, which Steve mm-hmm. spoke to. And then there's also making time, right? And so as I was saying to Debbie, sometimes you have to meditate to get yourself focused enough to get the creative thing going. And sometimes you're a little bit too stuck and you need to move your body so creativity flows. Mm-hmm. And so within the prioritizing of creation within the day, what you'll have to essentially decide is, are you, let's see how I can say this. When is a good time to be creative? Is it first thing in the morning? Before you do anything else? Or is it when you've taken care of the stuff that kind of spin around in your head so you have open-ended time to mm-hmm. create? I, for one, have a really hard time having open loops and really, really entering creative engagement. So I tend to want to close my open loops and then have a large stretch of time to be creative. But of course, sometimes that's not possible. And sometimes by the time I've closed the open loops, I'm so tired that there isn't much left. So you have to essentially examine your patterns around creativity and then structure your day such that you can do that.
That's great. Thanks. Yeah.
Mm. Okay.
Thank you both.
You're very welcome. There were a few people who sent in questions that we didn't get to, but we'll have another call next week anyway. If we collect enough questions, we might just record everybody's questions at some point. But yeah, keep on sending things in. Some of them we addressed. We'll post the information for the next call. Other than that, I think the only other thing to say is that the Awakening the Pleasure Body is open for all of April. If you want to join us in the 6 months online at home exploration. And I think that's about it. Thank you, everybody.